more than just infinite repositories for trivial snap judgments. They are more than merely convenient outlets for mindless joy and outrage. They offer more than the common ground and the solace we may find during culturally significant moments. Social networks also provide us with something of a flawed but necessary conscience, a constant reminder that commitment, compassion, and advocacy neither can nor ever should be finite. We cannot lose sight of what happened on June 25th because we are so consumed by what happened next. Nor can we lose sight of what happens today in favor of what tomorrow will bring. Traditional journalism can give us the grounding and context we dearly need, while social networks remind us that we do have today, that we can be mindful of the past and future while taking some time to appreciate the present. The Alienable Rights of Women. Reproductive freedom is on my mind. How could it not be? I'm a woman of reproductive age, and depending on where I live, my reproductive choices are limited. Often when I read the news, I have to make sure I am not, in fact, reading The Onion. We continue to have national and state debates about abortion, birth control, and reproductive freedom, and men mostly are directing that debate. That is the stuff of satire. The politicians and their ilk who are hell-bent on reintroducing reproductive freedom as a campaign issue have short memories. Of course they have short memories. They only care about what is politically convenient or expedient. Women do not have short memories. We cannot afford that luxury as our choices dwindle. Politicians and their ilk forget that women, and to a certain extent men, have always done what they needed to do to protect female bodies from unwanted pregnancy. During ancient times, women used jellies, gums, and plants, both for contraception and to abort unwanted pregnancies. These practices continued even into the 1300s, when Europe needed to repopulate and started to hunt witches and midwives who shared their valuable knowledge about these contraceptive methods. Whenever governments wanted to achieve some end, often involving population growth, they restricted access to birth control and/or criminalized birth control, unless, of course, the population growth concerned the poor, in which case contraception was enthusiastically promoted. Historically, society has only wanted the right kind of people to have a right to life. We shouldn't forget that fact. Here's the thing about history. It repeats itself over and over and over. The witch hunts and the demonization of contraception and abortion and the women who provided these services from the 14th and 15th centuries are happening all over again. This time, though, the witch hunt is a cynical ploy to distract the populace from some of the truly pressing issues our society is facing. The devastated economy, and a Wall Street culture that remains unchecked even after the damage it has done. The raging class inequalities and widening gap between those who have and those who have not. The looming student loan and consumer debt crises. The fractured racial climate. The lack of full civil rights for gay, lesbian, and transgender people. A healthcare system too many people don't have access to. Wars without cease, impending global threats, and on and on and on. Rather than solve the real problems the United States is facing, some politicians, mostly conservative, have decided to try to solve the female problem by creating a smokescreen, reintroducing abortion and, more inexplicably, birth control into a national debate. Women have been forced underground for contraception and pregnancy termination before, and we will go underground again if we have to. We will risk our lives if these politicians who so flagrantly demean women force us to do so. Thank goodness women do not have short memories. Pregnancy is at once a private and public experience. Pregnancy is private because it is so very personal. It happens within the body. In a perfect world, Pregnancy would be an intimate experience shared by a woman and her partner alone. But for various reasons, that is not possible. Pregnancy is an experience that invites public intervention and forces the female body into the public discourse. In many ways, pregnancy is the least private experience of a woman's life. Public intervention can be fairly mild, more annoying than anything else. People wanting to touch your swollen belly, offering unsolicited advice about how to raise a child, inquiring as to due dates or the gender of the not-yet child as if strangers have a right to this information simply because you are pregnant. Once your pregnancy starts to show, you cannot avoid being part of this discourse, whether you want to or not. Public intervention can be necessary because pregnant women must, generally, seek appropriate medical care. You cannot simply hide in a cave and hope for the best, however tempting that alternative may be. Pregnancy is many things, including complicated and at times fraught. Medical intervention, if you're lucky enough to have health insurance or otherwise afford such care, helps to ensure the pregnancy proceeds the way it should. It allows your fetus to be tested for abnormalities. It allows the mother's health to be monitored for the number of conditions that can arise from a pregnancy. If things go wrong in a pregnancy, and they can go horribly, horribly wrong, medical intervention can save the life of the mother and, if you're lucky, the life of the fetus. Public intervention is also necessary when a woman delivers her child, whether by the hands of a doctor, midwife, or doula. It is only after a baby is born that a woman might finally have some privacy. And then there's the manner in which the legislature, in too many states, intervenes in pregnancy time and again, particularly when a woman chooses to exercise her right to terminate. This choice increasingly feels heretical, or at least that is how it is framed by the loudest voices carrying on this conversation. Since 1973, women in the United States have had the right to choose to terminate a pregnancy. Women have had the right to choose not to be forced into unwanted motherhood. Since 1973, that right has been contested in many different ways, and during election years, the contesting of reproductive freedom flares hotly. Things have gotten complicated in too many states for women who want to exercise their right to choose. Legislatures across the United States have worked very hard to shape and control the abortion experience in bizarre, insensitive ways that intervene on a personal, should-be private experience in very public, painful ways. In recent years, several states have introduced and/or passed legislation mandating that women receive ultrasounds before they receive an abortion. 7 states now require this procedure. States like Virginia tried to pass a bill requiring women seeking an abortion to receive a medically unnecessary transvaginal ultrasound, but that bill failed. The Virginia legislature subsequently passed a bill requiring a regular ultrasound, in a bit of bait-and-switch lawmaking. This bill also requires that whether or not a woman chooses to see the ultrasound or listen to the fetal heartbeat, the information about her choice be entered into her medical record with or without her consent. The conversation about transvaginal ultrasounds has been particularly heated, with some pro-choice advocates suggesting this procedure is akin to state-mandated rape. That is an irresponsible tack at best. Rape is rape. This procedure, and legislation requiring this procedure, is something else entirely. Although I can assure you, a transvaginal ultrasound is not a pleasant procedure, primarily because there is very little that is pleasant about being half-naked in front of strangers while being probed by a hard plastic object, at least within a medical context. A transvaginal ultrasound is a medical procedure that sometimes must be done, but we cannot even have a reasonable conversation about the procedure and its lack of medical necessity for women who want an abortion, because the procedure is carelessly being thrown into the abortion conversation as yet another distraction tactic. Restrictive abortion legislation, in whatever form it takes, is a rather transparent ploy. If these politicians can't prevent women from having abortions, they are certainly going to punish them. They are going to punish these women severely, cruelly, unusually, for daring to make choices about motherhood, their bodies, and their futures. In the race to see who can punish women the most for daring to make these choices, Texas has outdone itself, going so far as to require women to receive multiple sonograms, to be told about all the services available to encourage them to remain pregnant, and, most diabolically, to listen to the doctor narrate the sonogram. This legislation designed to control reproductive freedom is so craven as to make you question humanity. It is repulsive. Our legal system, which by virtue of the Eighth Amendment demands that no criminal punishment be cruel and unusual, affords more human rights to criminals than such legislation affords women. Just ask Carolyn Jones, who suffered through this macabre ordeal in Texas when she and her husband decided to terminate her second pregnancy because their child would have been born into a lifetime of suffering and medical care. Her story is nearly unbearable to hear, which speaks to the magnitude of grief she must have experienced. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett supported legislation that will require women to get an ultrasound before an abortion. He suggested women simply close their eyes during the ultrasound. They will, apparently, let anyone run for office these days, including men who believe that not witnessing something will make it easier to endure. Georgia State Representative Terry England suggested, in support of HB 954, which would ban abortion in that state after 20 weeks, that women should carry stillborn fetuses to term, because cows and pigs do it too. Then he tried to backtrack and say that's not what he meant. Women and animals are not much different for this man, or for most of the men who are trying to control the conversation and legislation regarding reproductive freedom. 35 states require women to receive counseling before an abortion, to varying degrees of specificity. In 26 states, women must also be offered or given written material. The restrictions go on and on. If you think you're free from these restrictions, think again. In 2011, 55% of all women of reproductive age in the United States lived in states hostile to abortion rights and reproductive freedom. Waiting periods, counseling, ultrasounds, transvaginal ultrasounds, sonogram storytelling. All of these legislative moves are invasive, insulting, and condescending because they are deeply misguided attempts to pressure women into changing their minds, to pressure women into not terminating their pregnancies. As if women are so easily swayed that such petty and cruel stall tactics will work. These politicians do not understand that once a woman has made up her mind about terminating a pregnancy, very little will sway her. It is not a decision taken lightly. And if a woman does take the decision lightly, that is her right. A woman should always have the right to choose what she does with her body. It is frustrating that this needs to be said repeatedly. On the scale of relevance, public approval or disapproval of a woman's choices should not merit measure. And what of medical doctors who take an oath to serve the best interests of their patients? What responsibility do they bear in this? If medical practitioners banded together and refused to participate in some of these restrictions, would that make any difference? This debate is a smokescreen. But it is a very deliberate and dangerous smokescreen. It is dangerous because this current debate shows us that reproductive freedom is negotiable. Reproductive freedom is a talking point. Reproductive freedom is a campaign issue. Reproductive freedom can be repealed or restricted. Reproductive freedom is not an inalienable right, even though it should be. The United States, as we know it, was founded on the principle of inalienable rights. The idea that some rights are so sacrosanct, not even a government can take them away. Of course, this country's founding fathers were only thinking of wealthy white men when they codified this principle, but still, it's a nice idea that there are some freedoms that cannot be taken away. What this debate shows us is that even in this day and age, the rights of women are not inalienable. Our rights can be, and are, with alarming regularity, stripped away. I struggle to accept that my body is a legislative matter. The truth of this fact makes it difficult for me to breathe. I don't feel like I have inalienable rights. I don't feel free. I don't feel like my body is my own. There is no freedom in any circumstance where the body is legislated, not at all. In her article, Legislating the Female Body, Reproductive Technology and the Reconstructed Woman, Isabel Carpin argues, in the process of regulating the female body, the law legislates its shape, lineaments, and its boundaries. Too many politicians and cultural moralists are trying to define the shape and boundaries of the female body when women should be defining these things for ourselves. We should have that freedom, and that freedom should be sacrosanct. Then, of course, there is the problem of those women who want to, perhaps, avoid the pregnancy question altogether by availing themselves of birth control with the privacy and dignity and affordability that should also be inalienable. Or, according to some, whores. Margaret Sanger would be horrified to see how, nearly a century after she opened the first birth control clinic, we're essentially fighting the same fight. The woman was by no means perfect, but she forever altered the course of reproductive freedom. It is a shame to see what is happening to her legacy, because we are now seemingly forced to argue that birth control should be affordable and freely available. And there are people who disagree. In the early 1900s, Sanger and others were fighting for reproductive freedom because they knew a woman's quality of life could only be enhanced by unfettered access to contraception. Sanger knew women were performing abortions on themselves or receiving back-alley abortions that put their lives at risk or rendered them infertile. She wanted to change something. Sanger and other birth control pioneers fought this good fight because they knew what women have always known, what women have never allowed themselves to forget more often than not. The burden of having and rearing children falls primarily on the backs of women. Certainly in my lifetime, men have assumed a more equal role in parenting. But women are the only ones who can get pregnant, and women then have to survive the pregnancy, which is not always as easy as it seems. Birth control allows women to choose when they assume that responsibility. The majority of women have used at least one contraceptive method in their lifetime, so this is clearly a choice women do not want to lose. We are having inexplicable conversations about birth control, conversations where women must justify why they are taking birth control, conversations where a congressional hearing on birth control includes no women because the men in power are well aware that women don't need to be included in the conversation. We don't have inalienable rights the way men do. In 2012, Arizona introduced legislation that would allow an employer to fire a woman for using birth control. Mitt Romney, a supposedly viable presidential candidate that same year, declared he would do away with Planned Parenthood, the majority of whose work is to provide affordable health care for women. A mediocre, morally bankrupt radio personality like Rush Limbaugh publicly shamed a young woman, Sandra Fluke, for having the nerve to advocate for subsidized birth control because birth control can be so expensive. He called her a slut and a prostitute. More troubling than this oddly timed debate about birth control is the vehemence with which women need to justify or explain why they take birth control. Health reasons, to regulate periods, you know, As if there's anything wrong with taking birth control simply because you want to have sex without that sex resulting in pregnancy. In certain circles, birth control is being framed as whore medicine. We are now dealing with a bizarre new morality where a woman cannot simply say in one way or another, I'm on the pill because I like dick. It's extremely regressive for women to feel like they need to make it seem like they are using birth control for reasons other than what birth control was originally designed for. To control birth. When progress is made, such as the Affordable Care Act, requiring private health insurance companies to cover preventative services and birth control without a copay, said progress is hampered by the government shutdown in October 2013 because Republicans tried to include a one-year delay for the act in their budget proposal. Time and again, we see how women's bodies are negotiable. I cannot help but think of the Greek play Lysistrata. What often goes unspoken in this conversation is how debates about birth control and reproductive freedom continually force the female body into being a legislative matter because men refuse to assume their fair share of responsibility for birth control. Men refuse to allow their bodies to become a legislative matter because they have that inalienable right. The drug industry has no real motivation to develop a reversible method of male birth control because forcing this burden on women is so damn profitable. According to Shannon Pettypiece, reporting for Bloomberg, Americans spent $5 billion on birth control in 2011. There are exceptions, bright, shiny exceptions, but most men don't seem to want the responsibility for birth control. Why would they? They see what the responsibility continues to cost women, publicly and privately. Birth control is a pain in the ass. It's a medical marvel, but it is also an imperfect marvel. Most of the time, women have to put something into their bodies that alters their body's natural functions, just so that they can have a sexual life and prevent unwanted pregnancies. Birth control can be expensive. Birth control can wreak havoc on your hormones, your state of mind, and your physical well-being because, depending on the method, there are side effects, and the side effects can be ridiculous. If you're on the pill, you have to remember to take it or else. If you use an IUD, you have to worry about it growing into your body and becoming a permanent part of you. Okay, that worry is mine. There is no sexy way to insert a diaphragm in the heat of the moment. Condoms break. Pulling out is only believable in high school. Sometimes birth control doesn't work. I know lots of pill babies. We use birth control because, however much it might be a pain in the ass, it is infinitely better than the alternative. If I told you my birth control method of choice, which I kind of swear by, you'd look at me like I was slightly insane. Suffice it to say, I will take a pill every day when men have that same option. We should all be in this together, right? One of my favorite moments is when a guy, at that certain point in a relationship, says something desperately hopeful like, "Are you on the pill?" I simply say, "No. Are you?" I have regularly thought with shocking clarity, I want to start an underground birth control network. Of course, I also think, that's crazy. These smoke screens are just that. Things are going to be fine. Later, I realized the belief, however fleeting, that women might need to go underground for reproductive freedom is not as crazy as the current climate. I was, in my way, quite serious about creating some kind of underground network to ensure that a woman's right to safely maintain her reproductive health is in some way forever inalienable. I want to feel useful. I want to feel empowered. When I started imagining this underground network, I had a feeling in my gut that women and the men who love having sex with us are going to need to prepare for the worst. The worst, where reproductive freedom is concerned, is probably not behind us. The worst is all around us, breathing down our necks in relentless pursuit. Either these politicians are serious or they're trying to misdirect national conversations. Either alternative continues to expose the fragility of women's rights. An underground railroad worked once before. It could work again. We could stockpile various methods of birth control and information about where women might go for safe, ethical reproductive health care in every state. Contraception, abortion, education, all of it. We could create a network of reproductive health care providers and abortionists who would treat women humanely because the government does not, and we could make sure that every woman who needed to make a choice had all the help she needed. I spend hours thinking about this underground network and what it would take to make sure women don't ever have to revert to a time when they put themselves at serious risk to terminate a pregnancy. It could be fictionalized as a trilogy and made into a major motion picture starring Jennifer Lawrence. It surprises me, though it shouldn't, how short the memories of these politicians are. They forget the brutal lengths women have gone to in order to terminate pregnancies when abortion was illegal or when abortion is unaffordable. Women have thrown themselves down stairs and otherwise tried to physically harm themselves to force a miscarriage. Dr. Waldo Fielding noted in the New York Times, "Almost any implement you can imagine has been and was used to start an abortion. Darning needles, crochet hooks, cut glass salt shakers, soda bottles, sometimes intact, sometimes with the top broken off. Women have tried to use soap and bleach, catheters, natural remedies. Women have historically resorted to any means necessary. Women will do this again if we are backed into that terrible corner. This is the responsibility our society has forced on women for hundreds of years. It is a small miracle women do not have short memories about our rights that have always, shamefully, been alienable." Holding out for a hero. There's a great deal about our culture that is aspirational. From how we educate ourselves, to the cars we drive, to where we work and live and socialize. We want to be the best. We want the best of everything. All too often we are aware of the gaping distance between who we are and whom we aspire to be, and we desperately try to close that distance. And then there are superheroes, mythical characters embodying ideals we may not be able to achieve for ourselves. Superheroes are strong, ennobled, and graceful in their suffering, so we don't have to be. In Superman on the Couch, Danny Fingeroth writes, "A hero embodies what we believe is best in ourselves. A hero is a standard to aspire to, as well as an individual to be admired. We crave the ability to look up, to look beyond ourselves and toward something greater. We are so enamored with this idea of the heroic that we are always looking for ways to attribute heroism to everyday people so we might just get a bit closer to the best version of ourselves, so the distance between who we are and who we aspire to be might become narrower. Heroism has become overly idealized, so ubiquitous that the idea of a hero is increasingly diluted. Athletes are heroic when they are victorious, when they persevere through injury or adversity. Our parents are heroes for raising us, for serving as good examples. Women are heroes for giving birth. People who survive disease or injury are heroes for overcoming human frailty. People who die from disease or injury are heroic for having endured until they could endure no longer. Journalists are heroes for seeking out the truth. Writers are heroes for bringing beauty into the world. Law enforcement officers are heroes for serving and protecting. As Franco and Zimbardo suggest in The Banality of Heroism, by conceiving of heroism as a universal attribute of human nature, not as a rare feature of the few heroic elect, heroism becomes something that seems in the range of possibilities for every person, perhaps inspiring more of us to answer that call. Or maybe we have an excess of heroism because we have become so cynical that we no longer have the language or the ability to make sense of people who are merely human, but can also rise to the occasion of greatness when called upon. Heroism can be a burden. We even see this in the trials and tribulations of comic book superheroes. These heroes are often strong at the broken places. They suffer and suffer and suffer, but they still rise. Still they serve the greater good. They sacrifice their bodies and hearts and minds because heroism, it would seem, means the complete denial of the self. Spider-Man agonizes over whether to be with the woman he loves and cannot forgive himself for the death of his uncle. Superman is reluctant to reveal his true identity to the woman he loves to keep her safe from danger. Every superhero has a sad story shaping his or her heroism. Heroes also fight for justice. They stand up for those who cannot stand up for themselves. It's easy to understand why we might aspire toward heroism, even as we are aware of our limitations. As I watched the George Zimmerman trial unfold in 2013, I also thought a great deal about justice and for whom justice is intended. Zimmerman was on trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old boy who was wearing a hoodie and walking around being black. Zimmerman was a neighborhood volunteer watchman in his gated community in Sanford, Florida. For whatever reason, he wanted to protect his community. Perhaps he was as susceptible as any of us are to aspiring toward heroism. Nothing is ever simple. The Zimmerman case was about race. And when a high-profile case is about race, tension is inevitable. Very little about the conversation surrounding this case was rational. Zimmerman claims he shot Martin in self-defense. But Martin was unarmed, carrying a pack of Skittles and a bottle of iced tea. What precisely was Zimmerman defending himself from? This is one of the many questions for which we will never have answers. Some people, though, are trying. Fox News pundits hypothesize that, yes, indeed, candy and a bottle of iced tea could become murder weapons. What we do know is that a young black man is all too often suspected of criminality. Frankly, all black men are all too often suspected of criminality. In his beautiful essay for The Sun, Some Thoughts on Mercy, Ross Gay writes, "Part of every black child's education includes learning how to deal with the police so he or she won't be locked up or hurt or even killed. Despite my advanced degrees and my light brown skin, I've had police take me out of my vehicle, threaten to bring in the dogs, and summon another two or three cars. But I've never been thrown face down in the street or physically brutalized by the cops as some of my black friends have. I've never been taken away for a few hours or days on account of mistaken identity." Throughout the essay, Gay talks about how this education has shaped not only how he sees the world, but also how he sees himself. No one is exempt. I don't believe much in statements like, "We are Trayvon Martin," but for black men, it is often true. Zimmerman's lawyers worked throughout the trial to demonize Martin, to make him into the scary black man we should all fear, to make it seem like George Zimmerman had no choice and did the right thing. That strategy worked because Zimmerman was acquitted. Those lawyers played on the idea that a black man, or in the case of Martin, a black boy, is someone to be feared, someone who is dangerous. In theory, justice should be simple. Justice should be blind. You are innocent until proven guilty. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. You have the right to be judged by a jury of your peers. The principles on which our justice system was founded clearly outline how our judicial system should function. Few things work in practice as well as they do in theory. Justice is anything but blind. All too often, the people who most need justice benefit the least. The statistics about who is incarcerated and how incarceration affects their future prospects are bleak. I would like to believe in justice, but there are countless examples of how the justice system fails. In Georgia, Warren Hill, declared mentally retarded by four experts, was scheduled for execution on July 15, 2013. He was reprieved, though he remains on death row. Hill murdered his girlfriend, received a life sentence, and while in prison, murdered another inmate, which led to the death sentence. Hill has committed a crime. He deserves to be punished. Will his death serve as justice for his victims? Would justice in a courtroom, by way of a guilty verdict against George Zimmerman, really have been justice for the murder of Trayvon Martin? Would that measure of justice have comforted his parents and loved ones? Justice is, at times, a weak word. We would like to believe that justice is about balancing a crime with a punishment, but it is never an equal transaction. For most victims of crimes, justice is merely palliative. It would be just as easy to demonize George Zimmerman as it is to demonize young black men like Trayvon Martin. I hate what Zimmerman did. I hate how his trial unfolded. I hate the way his lawyers treated Rachel Jontel, the young woman with whom Martin was speaking on the phone just before he died and a key witness for the prosecution. Jontel did not bother hiding her disdain for Zimmerman's lawyer or the court proceedings, and he did not bother hiding his disdain for her. I hate what Zimmerman stands for, and I hate that he was acquitted, but I also understand that he is a man who was raised in the same country as Paula Deen, and he happened to have a gun. These things are connected. Trayvon Martin is neither the first nor the last young black man who will be murdered because of the color of his skin. If there is such a thing as justice for a young man whose life was taken too soon, I hope justice comes from all of us learning from what happened. I hope we can rise to the occasion of greatness, where greatness is nothing more than trying to overcome our lesser selves by seeing a young man like Trayvon Martin for what he is, a young man, a boy without a cape, one who couldn't even walk home from the store unharmed, let alone fly. A Tale of Two Profiles. There is no way to truly know whom we need to protect ourselves from. Dangerous people rarely look the way we expect. We were reminded of this in early 2013 when Jokar Tarniv, who looks like the boy next door, was identified as one of the two young men suspected in the terrorist bombings near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Three people were killed and nearly 300 others injured. This notoriety, I imagine, explains why Tsarniv was featured on the cover of the August 1, 2013 issue of Rolling Stone. The magazine was accused of exploiting tragedy, glorifying terrorism, and trying to make a martyr or a rock star out of Tsarniv. But protests aside, the cover is provocative and pointed. It is a stark reminder that we can never truly know where danger lurks. It is also a reminder that we have certain cultural notions about who looks dangerous and who does not. These notions are amply reinforced by the article accompanying the cover, something few people seem to be talking about: the tone of Janet Reitman's reportage and the ongoing conversation about Tsarniv as a normal American teenager are an interesting and troubling contrast to the way we talk about, say, Trayvon Martin, also a normal American teenager, but not a criminal or terrorist. George Zimmerman killed Martin because Martin fit our cultural idea of what danger looks like. Zimmerman was acquitted for the very same reason. Most striking in Reitman's extensive and well-reported article is how the people who knew Tsarniv are still willing to see the man behind the monster. Tsarniv is described by those who knew him in near-reverential terms as sweet and super chill and smooth as fuck and a golden person, really just a genuine good guy. While Tarnov's community acknowledges the terrible things the young man has done and mourn the tragedy of the bombings, they are unwilling to turn their backs on him. The article also reveals how shocked Tarnov's friends and neighbors were to learn he and his brother were responsible for such a crime. They were shocked because we have a portrait in our minds of what danger and terror look like, and it's not this golden boy on the cover of Rolling Stone. Time and again, the word normal comes up. He is described as a beautiful, tousle-haired boy with a gentle demeanor, soulful brown eyes. He enjoyed what most teenagers seem to enjoy: popular television shows, sports, music, girls. He smoked a copious amount of weed. He committed a monstrous act, but he retains his normalcy. Reitman's article is breathless in its empathy for Tarnov. Not only does Reitman meticulously reveal how Tarnov went from boy next door to terrorist, she seems desperate to understand why. She is not alone in this. When danger has an unexpected face, we demand answers. Family friend Anna Nikeva discussed the Tarnov's family's problems and concluded, "Poor Jahar was the silent survivor of all that dysfunction." Poor, poor Jahar. Reitman later notes that though it seems as if Jahar had found a mission, his embrace of Islam also may have been driven by something more basic, a need to belong. The article seems ultimately to be asking, how can we not have some measure of empathy for a young man with so simple a desire to belong? The empathy does not end with the reportage. There is also testimony from Wick Sloan, a community college professor who has taught many young immigrants like Tarnov. He says, "All of these kids are grateful to be in the United States, but it's the usual thing. Is this the land of opportunity or isn't it? When I look at what they've been through and how they are screwed by federal policies from the moment they turn around, I don't understand why all of them aren't angrier. I'm actually kind of surprised it's taken so long for one of these kids to set off a bomb." And there are even more of Tarnov's friends who are still stunned. Friends from college who found a backpack with emptied fireworks fretted about what to do because no one wanted Jahar to get in trouble. Even after all he has done, after all we know, Tarnov benefits from so much doubt from his friends, his community, and those who seek to understand him and the terrible things he has done. This, it would seem, is yet another example of white privilege. To retain humanity in the face of inhumanity. For criminals who defy our understanding of danger, the cultural threshold for forgiveness is incredibly low. When Trayvon Martin was murdered, certain people worked overtime to uncover his failings, even though he was the victim of the crime. Before his death, Martin had recently been suspended from school because drug residue was found in his backpack. There were other such infractions. This became evidence. He was a normal teenager, but he was also a black teenager, so he was put on trial and he was indicted. With Tarnov, people continue to look for the good. The bounds of compassion for the tousle-haired young man know few limits. Trayvon Martin, meanwhile, should have walked home without looking suspicious. He should have meekly submitted himself to Zimmerman's intentions instead of whatever took place on the fateful night of his murder. He should have been above reproach. As Sarita McFadden noted, "Only in America can a dead black boy go on trial for his own murder." Reitman's article is a solid piece of journalism. It reveals complex truths about the life of Jahar Tarnov. Imagine, though, if Rolling Stone had dedicated more than 11,000 words and the cover to Trayvon Martin to reveal the complex truth of his life and what he was like in the years and months and hours before his death. How did he deal with the burden of being the face of danger from the moment he was born? This is a question fewer people seem to be asking. The way we see danger is, in large part, about racial profiling, a law enforcement practice that has been hotly debated for years because it implicitly connects race to criminality. Racial profiling is what emboldened an armed George Zimmerman to follow an unarmed black man walking home, even after police told Zimmerman not to pursue Trayvon Martin. Zimmerman saw a young black man and believed he was looking into the face of danger. He hunted that danger down. The New York City Police Department's Stop and Frisk program allows police to stop, question, and search anyone who raises a reasonable suspicion of danger or criminality. The majority of people who are stopped and frisked in New York are black or Latino because these demographics fit our cultural profile of danger. These are the supposed barbarians at the gate, not the boy with the soulful brown eyes. Though there are many objections to the stop and frisk program and other forms of racial profiling, these practices persist. Former Mayor Michael Bloomberg defiantly supported the program. On his radio program, he said, "They just keep saying, oh, it's a disproportionate percentage of a particular ethnic group. That may be, but it's not a disproportionate percentage of those whom witnesses and victims describe as committing the murder. In that case, incidentally, I think we disproportionately stop whites too much and minorities too little." In her book, The Color of Crime, Catherine Russell Brown says, "Blacks are the repository for the American fear of crime," and also notes that, "For most of us, television's overpowering images of black deviance, its regularity and frequency, are impossible to ignore. These negative images have been seared into our collective consciousness. It is no surprise that most Americans wrongly believe that blacks are responsible for the majority of crime. No doubt many of the suspects paraded across the nightly news are guilty criminals. The onslaught of criminal images of black men, however, causes many of us to incorrectly conclude that most black men are criminals. This is the myth of the criminal black man." Over the past year, countless black men have stepped forward to share their stories of how they have been forced into this myth, but very little has changed. Racial profiling is nothing more than a delusion born of our belief that we can profile danger. We want to believe we can predict who will do the next terrible thing. We want to believe we can keep ourselves safe. It's good that Jokar Tarnoff is on the cover of Rolling Stone, tousled hair and all. We need a reminder that we must stop projecting our fears onto profiles built from stereotypes. We need a reminder that we will never truly know whom we need to fear. The racism we all carry. In the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical Avenue Q, one of the most popular songs is "Everyone's a Little Bit Racist." The chorus ends, "Maybe it's a fact we all should face. Everyone makes judgments based on race." There's a lot of truth to the song's lyrics. Everyone holds certain judgments about others, and those judgments are often informed by race. We're human, we're flawed. Most people are simply at the mercy of centuries of cultural conditioning. Most people are a little bit racist, but they're not marching in Klan rallies or burning crosses or vandalizing mosques. The better among us try to varying degrees of success to overcome that cultural conditioning, or, as revelations about popular butter-loving former Food Network host Paula Deen suggest, we don't. Paula Deen, who lives in Savannah, Georgia, revels in Southern culture, and her shows on Food Network, which aired for nearly 14 years, paid decadent and unapologetic homage to all manner of Southern cooking. She is a proud daughter of the South, and apparently she carries the effects of the South's complex and fraught racial history. A former employee, Lisa Jackson, sued Deen and her brother, Earl Bubba Ears, for workplace harassment. A damning transcript of Deen's deposition found its way online, and in it, Deen reveals all manner of impolitic views on race. When asked if she used the N-word, Deen blithely replied, "Yes, of course," as if it was a silly question, as if everyone uses the N-word. She's probably right. Dean goes on to explain that she used the word to describe a man who put a gun to her head during a holdup at the bank where she worked, as if this should justify the epithet. As Dean notes, she wasn't feeling real favorable towards him. That's fair enough. No one would feel favorable toward a man holding a gun to her head. Though one sin, however more grave, should not justify another. Two wrongs rarely make a right. She also discussed the racist, anti-Semitic, and redneck jokes told in her kitchens, and how her husband regularly uses the N-word. When asked about how she identifies people by race, she said, "I try to go with whatever the black race is wanting to call themselves at each given time. I try to go along with that and remember that." The entire transcript is as revealing as it is fascinating. It's a bit funny and a bit sad because Dean is so honest and her attitude is utterly unsurprising. I suppose I should be outraged, but I'm not. I'm actually baffled by how much attention the story received, where everyone seemed shocked that an older white woman from the Deep South is racist and harbors a nostalgia for the antebellum era. Or perhaps my lack of surprise reveals my own biases. Though I know better, I have certain ideas about the South. Is this where I say, I have Southern friends? The internet responded vigorously, as it tends to do when news broke of Dean's racism, or as I've come to think of it, Dean's general outlook on life. The Twitter hashtag Paula's Best Dishes instantly went viral, and all the major news sites have breathlessly hashed and rehashed what little we actually know from the deposition transcript, some hearsay and a whole lot of speculation. The most interesting part of the deposition is the blitheness of Dean's responses and the complete lack of shame. Her attitude was one of a person who is surrounded by like-minded individuals, a person who has been so thoroughly culturally conditioned that she doesn't know any better and doesn't have enough of a sense of self-preservation to tell a few little white lies about her racial attitudes. In truth, Dean does know better. She has certainly never said the N-word or made openly racist comments on air or in any of the countless media interviews she has done over the years. In the deposition, she even acknowledges that she, her children, and her brother object to the N-word being used in any cruel or mean behavior, as if there's a warm and friendly way for white people to use the word. This entire debacle reveals how there are unspoken rules about racism. In her deposition, for whatever reason, Dean decided to break those rules or ignore them, or she believed she was rich and successful enough that the rules, frankly, no longer applied to her. There is a complex matrix for when you can be racist and with whom. There are ways you behave in public and ways you behave in private. There are things you can say among friends, things you wouldn't dare say anywhere else, that you must keep to yourself in public. Writer Teju Cole succinctly identified why so many people are seemingly agog about these Dean revelations when he tweeted, "The real reason Paula Dean's in the news is not because she's racist, but because she broke the unwritten rules about how to be racist." Most people are familiar with these rules. We suspect that everyone is, indeed, a little bit racist. It's often not a question of if someone will reveal his or her racism to whatever degree, but rather when. Or maybe it's people of color who are familiar with these rules and willing to acknowledge they exist. Maybe it is people of color who wait, without bated breath, for that when. My downstairs neighbors moved out. They were Korean, college students. I never met them, but they seemed nice enough. They played loud music, but it was never enough of a nuisance to complain. Who doesn't like to party? When I went to pay my rent at the beginning of the month after they left, my landlord's receptionist began detailing the extraordinary measures they were taking to air out the apartment because you just wouldn't believe the smell. I nodded because I truly had no idea what to say, and then she leaned into me and whispered, "You know how those people are." This was one of those rare moments in which I got to see the rules of racism in action in a multiracial context. A white person felt comfortable confiding in me. In that moment, we were an us conspiring against a them. I couldn't think of anything snappy, so I simply said, "I have no idea what you mean," and walked away. I wasn't interested in playing that game where we bond as we reveal our racist secret selves to each other. Later, I felt guilty I hadn't used that moment to educate this stranger about race-based generalizations. I wondered why she thought she could reveal that casual racism in mixed company. I wondered, as I often do about people, what she truly thinks about me. Tragedy. Call. Compassion. Response. Every day, terrible things happen in the world. Every damn day, too many people die or suffer for reasons that defy comprehension. In Norway, in Oslo, in the city where the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded on a Friday afternoon, a 32-year-old man triggered a bomb at the government headquarters, killing 8 people. On the small island of Utøya, that same man killed 69 people, most of them teenagers. Children hid behind rocks and fled into the water and pretended to be dead so they might have a chance to survive, to live a day beyond the unbearable day they were living. There is fear and there is fear. The scale of the tragedy is incomprehensible. The tragedy, like most tragedies, tests the limits of language. There is now a before and after. That's what the news tells us. There are pictures of the building, decimated. The architecture's broken skeleton revealed. The dust and debris, the wounded, the dead, the mourning, the mourned. Candles melting, wilted flowers wrapped in clear plastic. Handwritten signs trying to properly express the depths of a grief that, perhaps, cannot be expressed. All too often, suffering exists in a realm beyond vocabulary, so we navigate that realm awkwardly, fumbling for the right words, hoping we can somehow approximate an understanding of matters that should never have to be understood by anyone in any place in the world. The man who committed these crimes has blonde hair and blue eyes. These details are shared repeatedly in a litany of disbelief. Too many people expected the perpetrator of this crime to have brown skin and a Quran, because we need to believe that there is only one brand of extremism. This is the world we now live in. We forget compassion. We pretend we are somehow different from those we otherwise condemn. The man with blonde hair and blue eyes has a Wikipedia page. A compendium of knowledge has been compiled about Anders Behring Breivik. We know his beliefs and his taste in music and what his parents do for a living. We know he has an exhaustive manifesto he worked on for 9 years, some of which he took directly from the Unabomber. We have seen him posing with a big gun, wearing a wetsuit. We have seen his face, his wide, open face, the youth in his features. We know he is extreme in his beliefs and that there must be hatred in his heart. We know he is crazy. He must hate. He must be crazy. We need to believe he is hateful and crazy because it is unfathomable to believe a man of sound mind and body could or would perpetrate such a crime. Crime is a weak word. A weak, weak word. Those 5 letters cannot accurately convey what is, more accurately, an atrocity. Even that word does not suffice. The tragedy exceeds our vernacular in so many ways. After this tragedy, the King of Norway said, "I remain convinced that the belief in freedom is stronger than fear. I remain convinced in the belief of an open Norwegian democracy and society. I remain convinced in the belief in our ability to live freely and safely in our own country." Tragedy. Call. Compassion. Response. He chose grace. He found a better vocabulary with which to respond amidst a suffering that defies vocabulary. We all have the capacity to do hurtful things, but we differ from one another in terms of scale, how much we can hurt others, how far we will go to make a statement about our beliefs.